Hello, welcome to the Anxious Conservative Podcast, starring me, Liam here, one of the Anxious Conservatives, and my co-host and good friend, Monique Poirier. Hey, g'day Monique, how's things?
Good evening, good, going well.
Yeah, well, it's good evening, but people might be listening to it in the morning, so
I've tried to... Good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
Yeah, I'm just trying to say hello. But nevertheless, that's fine. How's your anxiety at the moment? Are you anxious about anything at all?
It's been a bit up and down, actually, mainly just for health stuff, nothing major. But I don't know if you remember, and Twitter might remember as well, I sliced my finger open a few weeks ago.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, it was such a small little cut. Turns out I need plastic surgery on it. So, so I'm actually quite stressed about that. So
I'm sorry
a small little thing.
I'm sorry that my diagnosis in the DMs that it was fine was turned out to be wrong. So what said it get infected, obviously?
No, it was no infection, but the way it has scarred means I cannot bend it. And no amount of oil or vitamin E, which you're supposed to use, is helping it. So plastic surgery, here I come.
So why? What does the plastic surgery do? I mean, does it ultimately just be to remove the scar, is it, or what?
But yeah, they do something to the scar.
I'm not really sure what yet. Okay, so when the scar tissue's gone, you'll be able to bend it again.
Yeah.
So at the moment, is it just sticking out straight?
This is my normal finger. This one goes right in. This bit doesn't straighten. Sorry, for no one can see that apart from Liam. But
thank God it wasn't the middle finger.
Apart from that, all is great.
And are you sad about the news that the Duke of Edinburgh died this morning?
This morning? Yesterday morning.
Yesterday morning, sorry.
I as I scrolled through Twitter, I actually got a little bit emotional. I don't get emotional often, but yeah, it was pretty sad. And for me, I just feel for the Queen. As with any marriage of 70, whatever, however many years, that's got to be hard for them.
Yeah, and first and foremost, that's what it is, right? It's a human loss, and the fact that it happens every day makes it, you know, to regular people who aren't famous, that doesn't make it nearly sad. And the reality is that, you know, be it through celebrities or royalty or, you know, whatever, we actually do identify with famous people and we work our own feelings out through what they go through in public, you know. I mean, some people, I mean, you know, I'm not really that keen on taking a lot of judgment on this point, because I know that some people have this bizarre parasocial relationship with politicians, right? Like with Jacinda Ardern or I don't know, I suppose there might be some people who feel that way about Judith Collins or the US president. And so, you know, there's really no less different to, you know, just feel sympathy for the Queen and their family first and foremost, right? I mean, the Queen's now for the first time since the 1940s, a widow. And that would be hard for anybody. And just, you know, as much as she's everything else, she's a wife and mother. And
And her kids have also lost their father, and grandparents of grandchildren have lost a grandparent. And I think but there are some people who are losing sight of that.
I'm assuming that on, like, you know, people on Twitter were having an extremely normal one, because, you know, like, ultimately, you know, like, I'm sure that they would have a lot of perspective about the fact that somebody who was born in 1921, you know, might have said a few problematic things over the years, and they might probably, I'm sure that they would have related to their own grandparents and taken a really rounded view of it.
Yes.
And I'm absolutely certain that nobody on Twitter would be pleased that the Duke of Edinburgh has died, or, you know, like, you know, taking the occasion to bring out the worst things that he's done or the mistakes that he's made. So I'm just that's right, isn't it? My assumption that would be quite safe, wouldn't it?
Some of the vitriol was just...
Oh, what? I am shocked.
No, I thought you were being... I don't know whether you're being sarcastic at this point, Liam, but you are so lucky you're not on Twitter at this point because some of it was just disgusting.
I guess that a lot of people were talking about how he just had a life of privilege all his life, were they?
Also racist, sexist, all sorts of other things. Again, probably forgetting that their own grandparents and great-grandparents probably had some similar...
A few problematic thoughts in the years.
Yeah.
But there would have been a lot of acknowledgement about the fact that, you know, actually, you know, Prince Philip was a refugee. When he was a child, people came to kill his father, and his family had to flee Greece, and he had to be whisked out of the country in a fruit box. He had no country from that point on. His mother succumbed to mental illness, to schizophrenia, and was separated from his mother. And then he was actually a pretty heroic naval officer. You know, he...
So for some reason, the fact that his sister married Nazis makes him a Nazi, regardless of the fact that he fought in World War II.
But his mother protected a Jewish family.
Apparently that doesn't matter.
That doesn't cancel it out? All right.
His service doesn't cancel it out either.
Well, it's just, you know, like I've always wonder, you know, I think, you know, if you think about people who have fought fascism, I mean, you've got Prince Philip there, you know, he was
the Queen.
Prince Philip was actually risked his life. He was constantly at risk of being blown up by German U-boats. He was involved in the invasion of Sicily. You know, he saved dozens of lives when he took some quick thinking when he was second in command of that boat to save the ship from German bombers. So, you know, you think about those actions taken to fight fascism, but I guess the point is he didn't send hundreds of tweets a day talking about how much he hates fascists, I guess. So, you know, like if you weighed it up against, you know, New Zealand Twitter, you know, the typical anti-racist person on New Zealand Twitter against what Prince Philip actually did, you know, you'd have to say that the average person on Twitter in New Zealand probably coming out ahead in terms of what they've done for the world, wouldn't you?
Yep.
it's just the most performative, pathetic, loserish stance you can take is to take any person who's lived that life, who's that old, to judge them by the standards of today, and then to refuse to be judged by the standards of his day, I think. Yep. You know, and that's what I wrote about the other day. Like, you see it, you know, I mean, I'm sure that all these Twitter people would be storming the beaches of Normandy and doing all that. But anyway, look, I'm glad I'm not on social media at the moment, because I can just imagine how pathetic it was. People tripping over themselves to say how much they hated Prince Philip and were pleased that he was dead. But I'm sure that there were some nice people out there too.
Yeah, there were. And I think there was the acknowledgement that, yes, he lived a life of extreme privilege, but with that privilege, regardless of whether you're born into it or you're married into it, your life becomes a fishbowl. It is not an easy life.
Yeah.
And I don't think all the money in the world would make me want to live that life.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the point I would say is that, you know, like, I'm not sure that, you know, before he was in his 20s, like, you know, before he married the Queen, was he really that privileged? I mean, would you really switch
your... Well, no, he
married into it. As an adult. Which is no different to marrying, say, the Prime Minister or something like that, right? You know, so why is that different? I mean, to me, you think, can middle class New Zealanders really say that they would swap the lives they have now for being driven out of your own country as a child, having to, you know, crawling about as an infant on a crowded train in Italy if you're trying to flee your father being executed after losing a war, and then having no country and having to go, you know, moving around living on the money of other people, essentially, until you enrolled in the Navy and fought in the war. Do you think, I mean, does that sound...
I don't actually know if any of these people even know that he went through that. I really don't.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I guess that's the thing. It's judged first, and you know, and people are just ignorant, and and you know, I guess there's no fighting that now. You know, it's just. I mean, this is, but that's the other thing about the royal family, right? Is that they are this bridge to history, and you know, you don't have to be a monarchist, and I've got lots of friends who are, you know, quite against the idea of monarchy. But while we have it, the value that they have is that they are this bridge to this other world. And, you know, and by virtue of the fact that they have these long reigns, and hope, you know, God willing, like the Queen said, about 11 prime ministers and, you know, at least 11 prime ministers, that, you know, there's this repository of history there, the symbolism of continuity. And, you know, when Prince Philip died, like, you know, when someone like Prince Philip dies, it just remind you that that's not going to last forever. That time moves on. And so, I mean, that's kind of a bit sad for me too, you know. Are your grandparents alive?
No. My last grandmother died, or last grandparent died a few years ago. So, but all staunchly monarchists.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not even that. My grandmother had her birthday the other day, last week. She turned 98. And I just, what I always think about is, which makes me sad, is think, well, here's this woman who was born in the 20s.
Yeah.
Before, you know, Ceylon existed, you know, before there was television, you know, before all these, you know, the fax machine came and went under her watch. And all of that sort of experience is going to be lost to human memory now, and, you know, within a few, within a few years. And, you know, I suppose that's always been the way it is. But it is important and sad to note that, I think, and to treasure old people while we have them.
Speaking of fax machines, it's not quite the same, but I find it funny that kids these days don't know what it means to hang up the phone or to pick up the phone, or pick up's not quite the same, but hanging up, you know, that hanging it up back on the wall, or back on the, I don't know what you call that thing.
I sent a fax last week.
Well, I know it? Someone else who sent a fax last week, and honestly, come on.
It's superior technology. Well, the reason that we sent a fax was because the recipient's emails weren't working, and we had to get this notice to them. So they said, we trouble you to fax it to us. So I printed off the email and faxed it to them. So, you know, like, it's...
So what you're saying is, like, we should, every household should have a landline, one of those old school landline phones, just in case the power goes out. Is it the power? We should also have fax machines.
Yeah, that's right. And the monarchy, right? Because you never know when you're going to need.
Monarchy.
Because you never know when you need to get going to need to go back to it, when it might come in handy. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. I mean, are you a crown watcher? Did you like The Crown?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do I like The Crown? It's a guilty pleasure. Do I believe it all? No.
I thought that fourth season, where the one that was focused on Prince Philip, was one of the best seasons of television I've ever seen.
Is that the most recent one?
It was either this one or the second to most recent one.
Right.
It was the one that was about Prince Philip, and I think it was the penultimate one, because it was the one where Prince Philip was really sort of had that midlife crisis, and he sort of had to refine his faith.
I think that's the one before this. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and his mother, you know, Princess Alice was in it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And he did find his way through. And, like, of course he didn't become a perfect person. I mean, nobody does, right?
Mm.
But it did show a depth to him. I love the scene where he met the Apollo astronauts. Do you remember that one?
Oh, yes.
And he was so jealous of the fact that they did what he always wanted to do, to be explorers and be in the frontier. And then when he met them, they were just a bunch of nerds, you know, like, well, you know, like, they were just these sort of jocks, I guess, and had no philosophical insight to offer about what happened. They just talked about how the water cooler was loud. And it reminds me, you know, have you seen Apollo 13, the Tom Hanks movie?
No.
You know what happened on Apollo 13, though, eh?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I've watched documentaries on Apollo 13.
Well, when they made the movie Apollo 13, they got the transcripts, and they had to add in all the swearing and panic, because in real life, they were just too calm about it all. It wouldn't have been good drama, you know? So they, and that's what astronauts are like. And I like that thing with when Prince Philip sort of had that realization in The Crown that, you know, like what they did was amazing, but it wasn't, you didn't have to go to space to be philosophically fulfilled.
Mm.
And I think that was a really good, season. So maybe that's colouring me a little bit and my sympathy for Prince Philip. But I also do have a Duke of Edinburgh.
I might go back and watch The Crown, I think, now that we've talked about this. Actually, yeah, talking about your Duke of Edinburgh, when you asked a few weeks ago if anyone had done it, and I said no because I wasn't a loser, and I actually feel a little bit bad about that now.
Because do you know the background of that? How he started that? Why he started that award?
I don't know the background. Oh. No.
So when he was a kid, Prince Philip went to school in Germany, and that was because he had a family friend who was a teacher, and it meant they didn't have to pay school fees, which they couldn't afford. So I mean, there's no chance that Prince Philip of Greece and Denmark was ever going to go to a local school, but they couldn't afford to go to a good private school, so they sent him to this one in Germany. And the headmaster of that school was a German of Jewish descent. And the German, what he did was, when the Nazis came to power, he had to flee to England, to Scotland, actually. And so Prince Philip went with him. He set up this, you know, new school called Gordon Toon or something like that. And Prince Philip went there. And so this Jewish refugee who started the school, like, he had this philosophy about how young people were losing their way a bit because of the, you know, the arrival of cheap entertainment, right? You know, things that were instantly gratifying, like the cinema, I suppose. And that people were losing their appetites for things like outdoor exploration and, you know, their vigor and spiritual vigor.
Mm.
And so the cure that he had in mind with was, you know, young people should learn to master a craft.
Mm.
They should go on expeditions and mm-hmm. learn about the outdoors. They should do community service. Mm. And that sort of philosophy became the Duke of Edinburgh Award.
Right.
And that's the background of it, was that these are the things that young people need to become more spiritually fulfilled. And everything that that principal said is like true in spades today, because however many cheap entertainments there were to dull the senses of young people back in the, you know, in the 30s, it's overload now, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah.
You know, give a kid an iPad and he'll just sit there all day just watching someone else play video games on YouTube. It's the ultimate in passivity. And so, yeah,
what sort of stuff did you do?
Well, I hope that they never ordered it, but like you have to play a sport, right? So I played rugby all through school. Not very good at it, but I played it. For my skill, I did various different things. Learning to drive was one of them. And you would think, well, that's actually just something, well, you know, that's something every kid learns to do. But now, like, hardly anyone learns how to drive. It's funny, but, you know, I mean, we took that for granted a little bit. So I did a defensive driving course, and that that counted 1 year for the skill. I did community service. You know, I can't even remember what it was, but, you know, I don't know, probably picking up rubbish or something like that. And you had to do a certain number of hours. But the big thing that was always hard was you had to organise these tramps, right? And so but like the bronze level, you had to do an overnight tramp. And the silver level, you had to do a two-night tramp. And in the gold level, you had to do the a three-night tramp. And the three-night tramp was actually just one of the best. Like, I'm not an outdoorsman in any way, but the three-night tramp was just one of the best memories I got. I was with a bunch of mates because, you know, the school pushed it, and so it's fine. We did it with friends. We went up to Mount Holdsworth, and because we'd left it quite late, it was almost winter, and it snowed. It snowed really heavily, and we stayed up all night. You know, it was 17 years old at the age, with a roaring fire in a hut, with snow falling outside, telling each other ghost stories and scaring the crap out of each other, you know. And
where were you? Where the snow was?
Mount Holdsworth. So it's in the Tararua Ranges.
Oh, okay.
In Tararua Ranges. And, you know, I mean, it's People used to go skiing down Mount Holdsworth. They never had a ski lift, you know, but people used to pull themselves up with a rope. So it snows up there, but it was just, you know, and it's just a wonderful memory that I have. And I can see where the Duke of Edinburgh came from, saying that young people needed to have that kind of thing in their life. Because I hold on to that memory quite dearly, really. And I wouldn't have done it if there wasn't that structure around it.
Yeah.
Are you a tramper?
No, I am I mean, I love, you know, going to the Waitakere Ranges and walking on the tracks, but those are like a couple of hours, 45 minutes. I don't do physical activity all that well.
That's not true. You're like a ballet dancer.
Yeah, that's definitely a bit more arty than tramping.
I don't know. I think you'd be a pretty.
I'd be the person who got an injury within the first 20 minutes, and we'd all have to turn back.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, so there's varying degrees of fitness, right? And I was myself pretty fit back then because I was, you know, I played sports and had a high level of natural fitness, but not everybody in the group was. And so you always had the slowest person setting the pace, or you had a couple of groups, you know, to make sure nobody got left behind. And you know, that's part of it too, really. Anyway, I think, you know, if we wanted to round off the discussion about Prince Philip, I would say, you know, it'd be really easy just to look at somebody who's come from that background and just write them off on the basis of being an old man who said old man things and being a prince. And, you know, I just think that you make a mistake when you write anybody off without going and looking at their life and considering them as a three-dimensional person. You shouldn't do that, really.
Yep. Have a bit of compassion for the people around them as well, a bit of empathy.
Yeah, including historical empathy, really, I think, you know. And you've got to grade history on a curve, you know. God.
Yeah.
We judge our ancestors so harshly sometimes, and I think people don't realise how harshly we're going to be judged.
I was just about to say, in about 50 years' time, 100 years time, we will be considered, they'll be knocking down the statues of us.
Yeah, but they might, then they'll judge us on things as well that will surprise us, you know, things that seem natural to us, including to the woke set, are things that they will be judged on later on. It's just the way history works.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anyway, you had a really good piece to pivot to something much more positive,
that positive,
not at all, not for us anyway, but you had a really good piece at Kiwi Blog today about you know, the National Party's just lack of direction. You want to maybe just run through the bullet points on that one?
So there's no point, I guess, in looking back, as we National people do often, and say, you know, if it wasn't for COVID, we probably would be, or we'd have a high chance in government. There's no point in doing that anymore. That kind of part of history is over. And yet, despite that, Labor, let's just take COVID out of the situation as well, that the Labor's response to COVID, which, you know, I think was good. They have failed to deliver on all of their promises. They're screwing things up left, right, and center. The headlines are not always, well, more often than not now, are not good for Labor, and yet National still cannot make a dent in its credibility. And if it wants any hope of being able to be in government in 2023, it needs to start doing the work now, because right now it just looks like a mess, and it's a little bit embarrassing.
Yeah, you can't beat something with nothing, right?
Yep.
And even this,
I was talking with a friend of the podcast, Joe Ascroft, a couple of days about this, and National needs to do what Labor didn't do, and also know how it's going to implement its policy the moment it gets into government.
Yeah.
Because if we can't have 3 years of National government being accused of not delivering like Labor now, but also we want to be able to reap the benefits of long-term policy. So something that might take 3, 4, 5 years to get started, it needs to be started straight away. So that the government actually can take you know, say we were the ones who did it rather than it being completed when Labor's next in government.
Yeah. So what you're saying is not to have 100 working groups to tell the party what this policy should be 2.5 years after,
do the work now.
Yeah. Well, see, I've always thought was, nobody listens to me, but last year I told the party, well, then that was several leaderships ago too. I said, listen, what you want to do is go and hire the most respectable economist that you can find, an overseas one, right? So somebody from Harvard, pay out and get Larry Summers to do it for something, the former Treasury Secretary in the US and president of Harvard, and say, look, the party will pay for you to write us an economic plan, right, to get us out of the recovery. And then just keep emphasizing, we have a plan, we have a plan. The plan is here. This is what the plan is.
I still like my marketing idea of National's blueprint for New Zealand, because it plays on the word blue. Blueprint is vision and plan. So I really think there's something there. Anyway, keep going.
That's a really good name for it. But what we need to do is, New Zealanders have this terrible inferiority complex, and we need to have this overseas validation, right? So get it written up by someone at Oxford or Harvard or approved by them, and then go out and thump it and say, look, it's been vetted and approved, not by the leading world's leading economists. And the party could do that, it could come up with the money to do that.
Yeah,
pay them a consultancy fee to review it. And then, it does, what the policy is exactly doesn't need to matter so much then, right? Because actually I'm one of those ones who believes that policy doesn't win elections. I just don't think it ever has. But what it does, but having good policy does mean that when you get in there, you have the opportunity to implement it as soon as you can, right? Instead of leaving it all up to the civil service to come up with the ideas after you're in power. And I couldn't agree with you more.
Maybe we should do a little crowdfund or give a little page for the National Party, and so that we can get some money for a leading economist.
I don't know. Haven't we given them enough money over the years as members?
I think all of our money got spent on the 3 billboard changes last year at the election.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's the other thing that's been in the news, like this idea of a leadership change. And
both you and I have heard nothing of it, any credible.
When it came up, I like rang up people that I know, because I was like, well, I don't want to get caught out. Can you just tell me what's going on? They were like, what? No. Obviously, here's the thing. Like, I think all MPs who are ambitious see themselves as future leaders, right? But the time for any kind of leadership question now is not propitious. It's just not a propitious time for it. As people know, I was a Simon Bridges supporter. I wrote the first endorsement for him back in when he became the leader in 2018, and
I'm a supporter as well, obviously.
But all through that, when people were questioning him, like, my mantra was this: don't change your leader until you know that the change will bring in as many votes plus one more.
Mm-hmm.
And until you know that's the case, don't do it. And there's no reason why to think that would be the case now. There's no reason to think that changing the leader of the National Party is the thing that people are waiting for to switch their allegiance. And actually, first and foremost, there has to look like a credible alternative team.
The other thing that actually the main thing I don't like about the headlines is they become, that self-fulfilling prophecy. They start getting big heads, and because they see their names in the paper all the time, and so where there may not have been any intention, the more they see that they're being written about, the more they think, oh well, maybe we'll just give it a go.
It also forces people into challenges, prematurely, I think, as well. And I think that the Mueller coup on Bridges was a really good example of that, because it was a media creation, but it was pushed along enough by the media that when it happened in this very amateurish, very indecisive way, Yep. So, I mean, typically, if you want if the way that the National Party should organise its leadership challenges, and Labour can't do this because of their rules, but the National Party have very sort of pure Westminster type rules. The way that that it should happen is that on a rainy weekend, the challenger gets together with whoever's doing the numbers for him or her, and then they write up a list of people who are pledged to support them. On Monday, they give the list to the current leader, and that's it. The current leader resigns.
Yep.
And, you know, done dusted just like that. This drawn out in the media type of stuff is just not good for anybody, really. And I think one thing I would want to note is that, like, I feel that a lot of this leadership challenge stuff is coming from the ACT Party, and that's what kind of is annoying me at the moment. So you've got, like, Richard Preble kicking it all off. And he's an interested party. I mean, like, he currently advises the ACT Party. You know, the party who has the most to gain, the people who have the most to gain from Judith going as leader are probably the ACT Party. And I don't mean to sound conspiratorial there in any way. I'm sure it's not a conspiracy or anything, but their interests are in seeing a sort of more centrist National Party leader. And so that's their opportunity to increase their vote further. And so it's no surprise to me that I just see this coming from ACT a little bit, or this sort of agitation coming from ACT a little bit.
Yep, no, that makes sense. I kind of hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, like, I talked to some MPs during the week, and now that I say this, it's probably going to happen on Monday and make me look like an idiot, but, you know, there seemed to be some genuine surprise or genuine scorn at the idea that anything was going to happen anytime soon anyway. Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, which is not to say that Judith Collins is going to be the leader of the National Party forever. You know, I think anybody who loses the election has got to be a little bit careful. But the time having gone through this big review where the disunity was like the big thing that members keep hammering the party board and the party MPs for, the idea that now is the time for some sort of leadership ruction or controversy is just would be a joke, really.
Yeah, I agree. You never know with caucus, do you? I think
they started leaking again, exactly. Didn't they?
And I think sometimes they forget that behind them is actually a membership who have made, as far as I'm aware, quite clear that right now leadership change, at least now, is not the right thing.
And you know, as I say, Judith Collins won't be the leader of the National Party forever, you know, not because nobody's going to be leader of the National Party forever. And when that transition happens, as one day it inevitably must, you know, you would want it to be as orderly and decisive as possible. Not like the last two, really.
The complete opposite of the last two.
Well, anyway. Oh, that's all very depressing as well, I suppose, actually. So people might know that I've got a Patreon, which I've recently renamed to the Anxious Conservatives. And so we're gonna try and bring those sort of things, adventures, together. So Monique's gonna write for that as well. And we've already got internet personality Dean Nimbley writing. And then not as well known, but smarter than all of us, Joe Ascroft has written a piece, and hopefully will continue to do it. So I think I'm really looking forward to that. But I think if we can build that out, that can be a good kind of alternative voice in the media, I suppose, or alternative source of commentary anyway. I mean, we're never going to take on stuff, but, you know, like, it's it would be nice to have a regular outlet regularly putting out sensible center right commentary. So I'm just putting it out there in public so that you have to do it, Monique.
Well, I mean, if anyone, the hardest thing for me is actually figuring out things to write about and that will interest people. So for anyone listening, some of you already messaged me your ideas anyway, but can you please send me some stuff via the Twitter DMs if you want me to write about something? Give me some inspiration. Liam can write really quickly about anything, and it takes me.
I've realized I've been doing it for 10 years this year. That's actually quite a long time. I'm old. I'm 35. So it's 2011 when I wrote my first one for the Manual 2 Standard. And then I had every week 800 words to do every week, and I missed maybe three. One was, with a baby being born, and one was a health one. You know, but every other week I had to churn one out. And you actually do get quite quick at it, and you will too. Yeah. But
it's not the writing so much; it's the coming up with an idea first.
Yeah. Well, look, you'll be fine, because you're really the rising star of the centre right in New Zealand, and in the commentary space anyway. Because I'm old, and Ben Thomas is even older, and he's also not that right wing.
He's grandpa. Yeah.
He's a centrist grandpa. Like it's his right wing credentials is that he worked for Chris Finlayson.
Yeah.
Like his actual shtick or his actual alignment is being friends with everybody. You know?
Yep, he is friends with everyone on Twitter, especially, isn't he?
Yeah, he's this moderate. I'm having my Ben Thomas fix hang up. I'm working through it again. But he's like this.
This seems to happen a lot.
He's like the sensible, moderate guy who's absolutely lovely and gets on with everybody who's halfway sensible.
it's sort of the way to be, I guess, in terms of getting on with people. One thing for me is I obviously have a job that council doesn't like, but the people within council struggle to dislike me because I am a friendly person. Yeah. And I try and separate the two. So I think it's a good happy medium to try and find.
Yeah. I mean, the ARA, Auckland Ratepayers Alliance, of which you are the campaigns director.
Mm.
I mean, it's part of the taxpayers union, isn't it? But it's got a different, it's quite separate, a bit different. Yeah. It is quite separate. Yeah. And you're quite constructive, or you try to be, right? As well.
I'm trying to be. Yeah. Our submission on the long-term plan was to come across as something that was this is a good start. You've got more work to do, but this is actually a good start. Yeah. Good job, Auckland Council. So,
you had a really good piece in the local government magazine too. And,
that was quite a while ago. God, that was supposed to be apolitical, so I think I did a good job on that.
You did. I remember reading it, I think it was really good. But and of course you would have linked to that once on Twitter at like 2 p.m. on a Sunday afternoon, because you never promote
your
own work.
I'm not very good at promoting. I don't want people to think I've got a big head.
Well, listen, I'm sure that with that all that modesty, you'll go very, very, very far in punditry, which famously really rewards people for being modest and not being self-promoting. Oh, wait a minute. That reminds me. So one last thing I just want to talk about. Did you watch Q&A today?
I did.
I've got Jack Tames, good interviewer, eh? He did a
really good job this morning.
Yeah, he's really quite tenacious. And I think it's American background that he's got of, you know, working in the States. But he really did hold the Prime Minister to account in a friendly, not overbearing way. He sort of didn't let her off the hook for things.
Yeah.
But one thing that the Prime Minister did say that annoyed me was when Jack was pointing out about how all the other countries that have, passed us by on the way to the vaccine. And the Prime Minister said, well, we never thought we were going to be at the front of the queue, basically. We never thought that we were going to have an advanced rollout, because we don't have people dying, and so we were never going to be
rewriting history.
It wasn't just me that heard her say that, was it? I'm not.
No.
Did say that? Yeah.
Yep.
Why did Chris Hipkins say last November that we were going to be at the front of the queue?
Oh, he was being too definitive, I believe.
it was his personal opinion.
He was saying that in his personal capacity rather than as the COVID response minister.
That solves that. The vaccine thing really, really, really annoys me, because it's It is an example.
I think the thing that annoys me more is the backflips and hoops that the Labour partisans are jumping through to try and justify it.
The Labour bros, yeah, I know. Like, and it's like it's all inconsistent and it's just totally reactive. And the reality is that, you know, like Australia, we haven't been able to make deals like the other countries have. You know, we're probably a smaller market. And we don't have the clout. Just come out and say it, you know. And you know, but instead this. At one point, they were saying, "Oh, we don't know if the vaccine's safe." You know, like this, in, you know, like contributing to vaccine hesitancy down the line, rather than just admit that actually, despite the fact that the Prime Minister is pretty well regarded internationally, she doesn't have that much influence or pull.
No,
and you know, she can't order. She can't conjure up vaccines. You know, when other countries, which are, you know, have bigger markets, can beat us to them. And I just wish that we could be honest about that. But
I think that the hard thing about the Labour bros is that, you know, for example, in my piece today, I said that Labour had done a good job with its original response. And I got a little bit of shit for that because some National Party people cannot get through their heads that sometimes Labour can do a good thing. And equally with the Labour bros, they can't get it through their head that sometimes Labour isn't always doing the right thing.
It's a good observation.
It's very frustrating.
It's the flip side of the, you're quite right on both those points. And what the line I've always said is, look, you know, the Labour government it didn't do perfectly, but it made the big call correctly before it was too late. And if you want proof of that, look at the election result. Right? The people in New Zealand aren't idiots. You know, they rewarded the government for getting the big thing right.
Yeah.
And I think if the National Party supporters want to continue being churlish on that, it's just going to be a longer and longer period of opposition.
They're not wrong in that it could have been made earlier. You know, you had Simon Bridges call and David Seymour, I think, or maybe it was Mike Hosking, I don't know, two of them calling for the lockdown earlier. And yes, you can argue that Labour didn't go hard and fast, but we still only had 25 people die. And, you know, our economy is doing okay at the moment. They made the right call eventually without it being too late.
So, and that's right. So, you know, I mean, David Seymour, with whom I have a mixed relationship, he called very early on to suspend flights out of China.
Yeah, he wanted the borders closed, eh? Yeah.
But what do you think people said about David Seymour saying that?
He's racist and,
and
scaring people.
All the people who now are explaining why the Prime Minister's right to close down flights. Yeah, exactly. It was the exact same people. The thing is, they don't miss a beat. It doesn't matter to them that they're totally inconsistent because they don't care. And then in their minds, they don't even think they are.
Speaking about those India flights, Jacinda had an interesting response to that this morning. I don't know if you remember, but
I would never do that.
She said it's a different a year ago to what it is now with the health advice they received about closing flights down or stopping flights coming in, but that doesn't stop the fact that she said she would never stop people coming in to the country and it was a weird response that I'm actually going to go back to and listen.
Another weird thing that happened was she said, Jack Tab said, well, how do you know that this policy would ever be made on along racial lines or reasons based on racial lines? And she said, because I would never agree to that. We would never make policy on that. Well, actually, they did a foreign buyers ban on the basis of their Chinese sounding names policy.
Yep.
That was the impetus for that. It always is. That's different. I know. But hang on. What's the credibility of saying that when they did this big change to the law that was, you know, at its core pretty xenophobic, blaming people who are more likely to be born overseas for the house price crisis. They made a big policy change on the basis of that, racially profiling a list of stolen names from a real estate agency. Didn't do anything. And yet now she says, well, just trust us. You know, just trust us because of our good track record. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, well, look, that's good. A bit of Labour bashing always
Makes me feel better.
Get my spirits up. Yeah. After a somewhat depressing podcast. Okay. All right. What are you up to this week? You got heaps on?
Working. I have been injured the last 2 weeks, so I'm hoping I can get back to the my back from emptying the dishwasher. So just able to kind of sleep through the night. I'm hoping I can get back to the gym today because my marathon training's been put on hold.
Back there, tricky too. Like, so is it one of those back injuries where you just got to keep working on it? You got to keep being active for it to come
I need to get strong again, if you recall at the beginning of the podcast, I am not. So
what are you taking for Voltaren?
I'm not on anything anymore, but I was on Voltaren. What are you up to?
I've got a week of hard week ahead of me, but
you're going to get to your emails.
Yes, I'll have to hang up this and produce the podcast and do all the other procrastinations that I want to do. Then I'll get to it. It's Monday night. It's going to be a long week. You always suffer. As professional services firms, we close for Easter Monday and Tuesday, and just always suffer for that 3-day week. It's not. It's almost not worth it, really.
Yeah. So are you going to make a return to social media?
Never, if I can avoid it. It's just not worth it. You know, it's not worth the time to spend with these. You know, getting into arguments with these losers. And
I know, you get yourself into that situation.
Yes, I know. But that's what the platform is there for the purposes of engagement, right? Mm. So, I mean, that's if you're using it properly, you're using it to engage, and you need to be responsive. Otherwise, you know, it's just a publishing platform, and you know, I can just use the podcast one for that. But you know, it's like, you know, the minute you get drawn into it, well, maybe it is partly personal to me, but I know that the minute I get drawn into it, I will not be able to suck myself out of it, and I'll pull myself out of it. And I just look at some of my friends who have, you know, given up the ghost on it. So Matthew Hooden has, Dean Nimbley has. They waited that 30-day period until all of their their account was gone totally. Mm-hmm. And if they wanted to restart, they'd just start from scratch with zero followers. And that, I think the prospect of that humiliation has really helps. You know, like, you don't want to start off as a normie with, you know, like 62 followers. You know, you give anyone with less than 1,000 followers is a common person, I suppose.
You're all leaving me, and I'm going to be.
You should leave too. You should leave too. We've got the good offline group chat going now. You know, and that's actually just quite reasonable and nice, you know, like, so yeah, let's, you know, listen.
The thing is, you get the news so much faster on Twitter. That's the good thing.
But what you can do for that is you can set up if you wanted an account that just was called, you know, had some random name on it, and just follow the news services and accounts and just be a lurker and not engage. Well,
that's what I started off as. And then here I am.
Yeah, exactly. And it's good in a way, like, it does build a media presence, and because Juno spent all their days on Twitter, like their whole days, some of them, it does mean that you get access to them and you can influence them, and that's the one good thing about it. But the problem is that, I don't know, I think we've talked about it before, there's a study I read in The Guardian a couple of years, like last year maybe, and it said that, you know, there was the demographics of Twitter where, you know, the biggest block was center left. The next biggest block was extreme left. The third biggest block was extreme right. And the smallest block at 8% was center right. So, you know, if you're a sensible conservative or a middle of the road conservative.
And then there's us too. Conservatives.
But yeah, that's right. But if you're such a minority right from the outset, you know, like, you know, that platform is always going to be against you, I think. You know, you're going to get it in the neck, as you have today, from people calling you a Labour shill because you simply say that the Labour Party did good.
It was just funny, though.
Pandemic. I know, but that's the thing. So, you know, you'll get it from those people, and you'll get it from other people who will call you, you know, racist and all these other horrible things at the drop of a hat for no reason. Mm. There's not really a lot of percentage in being there for us if you can get access to journalists in a different way. And, you know, I'm older than you, I'm luckier, so I've got their phone numbers for the most part. So I can work the ref that way. But, you know, if I can stay away from it, you know, I will. But, you know, like the proverbs say, you know, is the dog returneth to his vomit, so the fool repeats his folly. And I've tried to quit Twitter about 10 times. I'm a recidivist. I just hope that this time I can make it on the outside. Hope I can become rehabilitated, useful member of society again.
I don't know what my life was like before it. And it was only a year ago. I've only been on it for just over a year.
It was happier, Monique. You spent more time with your actual friends.
Yeah.
Instead of these fake friends in this fake community. You know, although, you know, you and I are friends now, and that's nice.
Yeah, I actually have made real friends off it, which is cool.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, well, it's not all
real
bad.
In life friends.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that's true. But, and you can keep those friendships afterwards anyway.
Mm.
Okay. All right. Well, look, we don't thank our listeners. It's been a long time since our last podcast, and we'll try to do them more regularly as part of the Anxious Conservatives media venture.
Got a few people lined up. We just need to make the time for them, or they need to make the time for us.
Some good ones. So actually, you want to be in charge of booking them instead of me, because I'm quite unreliable on that. And you've got all the contacts now. Yeah, cool. So look, we'll come to you in the next week with another podcast. Hopefully you'll listen the next 10 days. But as for tonight, or today, whenever you're listening, I think that'll do. So this was the Anxious Conservatives podcast. That was Monique Poirier, and I'm Liam here saying goodbye.